Asked to give a tutorial on asymptotic methods, and so a couple of disclaimers at the outset. One, you know, I think we have people with a range of backgrounds here, so some, at least half of what I will say will be, you know, trivial to many people in the audience, but maybe some people will learn a few things.
I assume this is a high school class.
Okay. Okay, I will not assume very much. And secondly, everything I discuss today will be formal. That is, I will make no attempt at rigor. I'm not a proper mathematician, so bear with me. Okay, so the plan is, if there is time, to sort of do this in two parts. There'll be sort of this mini tutorial on asymptotic methods, particularly as applied to PDEs. I think a lot of maybe physicists tend to learn about perturbation methods for systems of ODEs, but not necessarily the PDE context. And then the second part of the talk would be an application to current research involving coupled uniform momentum zones and internal shear layers in turbulent wall flows. I'll give the outline in just a minute, but let's set the stage here first. Okay, so when we non-dimensionalize a system of PDEs, generally one or more dimensionless parameters appear in the problem, and usually at least some of these parameters in regimes of interest are large or small. So in Newton's second law, that implies that not all of the forces are equally important for all time everywhere in the flow. Okay, so we have small or large parameters in the PDEs. That generally implies a separation in spatiotemporal scales, and sometimes a separation in the amplitudes or magnitudes, sizes of different field variables, velocity components in anisotropic flow structures, for example. The idea is that, well, maybe we can exploit this by looking for an asymptotic, not an approximation, so from function of x, independent variable x, and parameter epsilon, we seek a so-called regular perturbation expansion written here. Okay, so the idea is that these gauge functions have to be orderable as epsilon, a real positive number, tends to zero from above. Okay, so delta 2 over delta 1 goes to 0 as epsilon goes to 0, delta 3 over delta 2, etc. But actually, that's not the definition of asymptoticness. The definition of asymptoticness is that the residual, that the ratio of the last term in this expansion, so I guess it's the n plus first term, if you will, which is the product of the gauge function delta n times this f capital N of x, that in the numerator over the, or sorry, that in the denominator, and the residual, the difference between the exact solution, which of course you don't know, and the remaining terms without that capital N term, must go to zero. So let me say that again, sorry. The residual between F and N terms here, which means you go out to capital N minus 1, that in the numerator, over the last, have I said this backwards three times now? I'm sorry.
I think so.
Yeah, I apologize.
Write on the blackboard.
I'm going to use the board very soon, which hopefully will be good news, but we'll see. So what I'm trying to say is that we need f of x and epsilon minus the sum, say, from n equals 0 to n minus 1 of delta n of epsilon f n of x over the last term we keep. I feel like I've got this backwards. Is that what I want?
Oh, you want n in the sum.
What's that?
You want n in the sum?
Sorry. Thank you.
And then that goes to zero?
Yep. Thank you. Yeah. Sorry.
Well, it both should go to zero.
Okay. Sorry, going the wrong way there. So, but what I wish to emphasize is that, so it's, you know, it's not sufficient, of course, to know that the delta n's, these gauge functions, are ordered. One also needs to worry about the fact that fn, if we're talking about differential equations, for example, not just algebraic equations, depends on, say, the coordinate x, and so maybe fn gets big or something in some region of x. So we have to worry about the uniformity in x, or Y, Z, and T as well, of our expansion, okay? And so this quote-unquote regular perturbation expansion sometimes will, frequently will be non-uniform in problems of interest. Sorry. There we go. And so we need to fix, okay? So first of all, what are the sources of non-uniformity? I mean, there are many, but I think the ones that are most important are infinite domains. Okay, so in the case of initial value problems, think of a harmonic oscillator that is weakly nonlinear or weakly damped or something, time, you know, goes off to infinity generally, if you're worried about the large time behavior. And another possibility that we're all familiar with is a change of type or reduction of order of the governing equation. So these are the sources of non-uniformity that cause trouble for this expansion, and then one must suitably generalize that expansion. As shown here. So now instead of lowercase fn of x, we have capital Fn of x and epsilon, where, for example, we have basically rescaled x. So this would be one example of what this capital Fn might look like. And we're going to fix that quantity, x on epsilon, call it capital X or something, as we take the limit epsilon goes to 0. So the key challenge, and I think what makes this mysterious for a lot of people, is how do we find the appropriate rescalings? Hopefully it's not magic, but there is a lot of trial and error involved, guided by some understanding of the physics, guided by so-called dominant balance arguments, and sometimes by, just looking at the way the regular expansion breaks down often gives you very important clues. Okay, so this is a very pragmatic approach that I'm taking here.
But yes? How do you choose between different rescalings, say, two candidates that both work? Which one do you choose?
That's what I'm saying is sort of the primary challenge in this whole game, okay? And generally, I don't think there will be two that quote-unquote work, okay? So sometimes you have to chase the analysis down a fair way to convince yourself that one approach is correct and another is not. And a case in point is the part two, this project that we're currently pursuing. So, but there are, as I say, it's not just completely trial and error. There's certainly some rules of thumb that I'll try to illustrate in the worked problems. I don't know who is next, I think.
So I've heard that there's these renormalization group methods where you don't need to a priori.
Great. Guess the scalings or, you know, be inspired to deduce the scalings. That's right. Okay, so I am no expert at renormalization group methods, but there are indeed deep connections between one of the approaches that I'm going to describe in a moment and renormalization group theory, okay? And you're right, renormalization group theory, as far as I understand it, has this advantage that it kind of is an automated procedure, an algorithm one can follow that in these perturbation problems will generate sort of the expansion sequence and the scalings or rescalings for you. However, I am not familiar with RNG renormalization group theory as applied to nonlinear PDEs, for example. And if we're talking about Navier-Stokes, that's what we're interested in.
No.
Carry on.
Yeah, I didn't. So, you know.
I mean, Nigel Goldenthal will be here, and he's an expert, so we can ask him. He'll be in 2 weeks.
Yeah.
So you don't necessarily know this F.
This one. So, yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you, Denise. Is this what you're talking
about?
Yeah. So, of course, you know, part of the reason everything I'm saying is formal is I can never really prove asymptoticness in the problems that I'm going to be talking about because I don't know the answer, okay? So, of course, you generally don't know the answer, but there's still clever people out there who can manipulate the exact governing equation, you know, say a PDE or ODE, and thereby prove asymptoticness. But I'm not going to attempt to do that, okay? So instead, all I can do is be satisfied with maybe consistency, you know, that the next term in the series
so
beyond
you
the...
use data or something?
Well...
Data doesn't give you proofs.
I mean, yeah, data
Well, no, I mean to evaluate one approach versus another.
Oh, certainly you can do that, but that's a different question from... Yeah. Rigorously demonstrating
asymptotic. Absolutely.
Okay.
Just one minor thing. When you say f of n equals x over epsilon, I think you mean f of n equals f of x over epsilon.
I do.
That's a choice of restate X over epsilon.
I mean, that, I suppose that could have been a particular effect.
It could be. That might be the solution, too.
But this...
That's not what you meant.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so I don't know how to write it now. I guess I'm going to write that it equals that. Okay. So the important point is that we would keep that quantity, that ratio, fixed as we take the limit. Okay. So there are a myriad of asymptotic or perturbation methods one can find in the literature, and they, you know, depending what culture you come from, physics, engineering, mathematics, you tend to have different terms or your favorite tool. But again, for PDEs, I personally believe that the two most robust methods that seem to encompass almost all others, as far as I can tell, are the so-called method of multiple scales and the method of matched asymptotic expansions. So multiple scales, for example, encompasses so-called two-timing, the method of averaging, homogenization theory that solid mechanicians like to homogenize composite materials and find effective coefficients, global WKBJ analysis, nonlinear wave theory, etc. Okay. The method of matched asymptotics, I don't know, maybe strain coordinates is one other term that sort of falls under here. But I think the mental picture one wants to keep in mind regarding the distinction between these two tools are illustrated nicely by these pictures. So the method of multiple scales is appropriate and useful when one has a signal, okay, F, that varies simultaneously, sort of throughout the domain of the independent variable, on two scales. So if this is space, then, you know, adding up, getting a beating pattern, we see we've got a small spatial scale, right, the wavelength of the carrier wave, and a slow spatial scale, the wavelength of the envelope. Okay. Now this is obviously highly idealized, and one wonders what this has to do with turbulence. But nevertheless, just in terms of the pedagogy, I think this is a very helpful picture to keep in mind. That coordinate could be space, it could be time. In the method of matched asymptotics, by contrast, we have two or more usually spatial scales, but they could be temporal scales. But they occur in different parts of the domain. So if this is x and this is some f, and we had epsilon, as epsilon goes to zero, this particular function becomes steeper and steeper near the origin. So we have this region of rapid variation and then a region of slow variation. And then the name of the game is sort of divide and conquer. You want to chop the domain into two, get simplified problems in each subdomain, and somehow link those two approximations. Okay, so here now is the outline that we've, now that we've introduced some lingo. What I'm going to try to do is go through a very simple ODE example of involving the method of multiple scales, just to get everyone on, you know, same page. Then I would like to do a more involved PDE example of the method of multiple scales drawn from pattern formation theory, since some of us are interested in patterns formed by exact coherent states, for example. So this is on multiple scales. Then I would like to do a simple ordinary differential boundary value problem illustrating the method of matched asymptotics. And the more complicated version of this would be to apply it to Navier-Stokes to think about the construction of an exact coherent state, an equilibrium state, in the outer region of turbulent wall flows at large RE tau. And we'll see that in the process, we'll even understand VWI in the process. So if you're interested, you got to stay for the full duration here. I have a question, because, you know, again, I don't know everyone's background. So maybe it's a request. If I'm going too slowly, if everyone's familiar, please tell me to speed up.
How are we meant to know if you're going too slowly?
Yeah, that's a good question. How about,
just go and we'll see.
Yeah. But let me ask one thing right away. Is after doing an ODE example for the method of multiple scales, I could jump to an ODE example for matched asymptotics. That way, if you've eaten your lunch, you've seen enough, you know, you could have a taste of each. As I say, this problem would take a little bit longer. So I'll leave that to the audience, the discretion. Before I get to the blackboard, let me make a case for asymptotics. You know, I had described myself as a dinosaur in the meet and greet, but, you know, I believe asymptotics does have, you know, it's another tool in our chest along with numerics and experiments. I think we should use it. I'll say possible relevance of asymptotic methods to some of the activities that we're pursuing in this workshop. Certainly, we heard from Keith Julian last week on the derivation of reduced PDEs for less expensive numerical simulations or for numerical simulations in parameter regimes that are not yet accessible by DNS. This has got a long and very successful history in geophysical fluid dynamics. I'll show you pictures of two examples on the next slide. So my point here is that the PDEs one obtains with the method of multiple scales, which is the approach that, say, Keith Julian and Edward Knobloch have used, is not limited to some weakly nonlinear phenomenon. I mean, if, for those of you that heard Keith's talk, he was showing simulations of the reduced PDEs that looked, for all intents and purposes, to be turbulent dynamics. I think asymptotic methods may be useful in the development of pattern formation theory for exact coherent structures. And so here the important point is, although today I'll show you an example of weakly nonlinear pattern formation, the techniques are not limited to weakly nonlinear or small amplitude structures. There are techniques for finite amplitude structures as long as they're slowly modulated. All right, multi-scale numerical methods, if you look under the hood, very many of them are really grounded in asymptotic type reasoning, at least. The GQL approximation, which Brad Marston talked about last week and I think is talking about today in engineering, was really motivated by an asymptotic analysis of barotropic jets. And again, in the second part of the talk today, if I get time, I will describe our current work on matched asymptotics for ECS. And so just on the method of multiple scales, so Keith Julian was talking about, say, Rayleigh-Bénard convection, heat from below, cool from above, but rapidly rotate, okay? So crank up the forcing, the delta T, and rapidly rotate the system. That is a turbulent flow, but one that is strongly constrained by that rapid rotation. And so, you know, here are the governing equations, non-dimensionalized in some suitable way. The strong external constraint induces these anisotropic flow structures that basically satisfy or are trying to satisfy the Taylor-Proudman constraint. And it reduces mode coupling in certain directions. So you can see if the so-called Rossby number is small, this Coriolis term rises up and becomes very important. Yes?
So I have a comment about the
huge. Yes.
So when he does a W expansion, you lose some boundary conditions.
Mm-hmm.
You basically force your place to be free slip instead of no slip.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been recently found that the no slip can play quite a big role. So I don't know if you're familiar with the work. Just saying that that expansion has its very big caveats.
Well, first of all, Edgar and Keith showed a long time ago that the boundary layers, the mechanical boundary layers, are passive. So their expansion does not imply that you have to impose free slip or stress-free conditions. It works for no-slip boundary layers, but those layers are passive. I think the issue is when you crank up the so-called reduced Rayleigh number, okay, sufficiently high, there are limits to the theory. You eventually introduce new smaller scales or something that violate the assumptions or the scalings that are built into their reduced equations.
Shows
that depending on free slip or no slip, they stop working. And it does imply that the equations are free slip because you lose boundary conditions. So, okay. Just on the point of this, they also derive new reduced equations that have different boundary conditions, and then they do recover what you get in the NSR experiment.
I'm not going to defend Keith's work other than to say that. I mean, my primary point in bringing it up is just to say, again, for those of you that were here last week, that although today I will, derive a weakly nonlinear amplitude equation or something, and you're thinking, okay, boring, you know, what does that have to do with turbulence? The point is that the multiple scales methodology has been demonstrated to be useful in certain regimes, okay? So, and this is an example near and dear to my heart to do with Langmuir turbulence in the ocean, but I won't dwell on that. Okay, so now I'll get to the blackboard. So we'll go back to a simple ODE model for the method of multiple scales.
Okay.
Okay, so we'll consider, as I say, a very easy sort of problem or system. We have a weakly damped oscillator for a mass on a spring. The displacement is eta, which is a function of time, and we have this damping coefficient beta. So we let the mass go not from rest, but from zero displacement with some speed. The exact solution is easy to write down, so let's just record it. It's e to the negative beta t on 2 over the square root 1 minus beta squared on 4. Oops, it's beta squared. And then sine of, okay, I'm going to run out of space here, so let me call this something. Square root nu t. So nu is 1 minus beta squared on 4. Okay, so there's a damping, and there's an oscillation, and with this prefactor. And the question is, say we're interested, we happen to be interested in the limit of very weak damping. So beta is small, okay? So for small beta, and the key thing is fixed time t, we just have a Taylor series expansion that eta is asymptotic to sine of t minus beta t on 2 sine t plus beta squared on 8 t squared sine t plus sine t minus t cosine t.
Greg, is that the regular perturbation expansion in for small beta?
That's a point I would like to get to. Right. So at the moment, I'm not doing anything except I'm saying I have the luxury of...
That's the Taylor expansion.
Yeah. I have the exact solution, and so I'm just doing a small beta a Taylor series and looking at it and observing it. Okay. Of course, by observation, I can see that this is not a great approximation if T is large. In particular, if T is of order 1 on beta, this is not a great approximation, right? Not good for t equals order beta. So I'm already seeing some sort of issue. Let's see how we get that, as Mike was suggesting, by developing a so-called regular perturbation expansion, okay? Which is where one should always start, because the way a regular perturbation expansion breaks down usually tells you, you know, gives you some clues as to how to fix things up. So we posit that eta of t and beta, we're just positing, we're throwing, you know, taking a leap off the cliff, that this is, goes like eta naught of t plus beta eta 1 of t plus beta squared, eta 2 of t, etc. Now, there are lots of questions right away. I mean, do I know the expansion starts at order 1? Do I know the so-called expansion sequence proceeds in integral powers of beta, etc.? And there are ways to sort of determine these coefficients sequentially, but let's just give this a whirl. So we take this expansion, and we stuff it into the ODE, and we collect terms at like order in beta. So with order beta to the 0, that is order 1. We have our undamped oscillator with the initial conditions. So one must also substitute the expansions not only into the governing PDE or ODE, but also into any initial or boundary conditions as well. It's important to keep that in mind. So eta naught of 0 is 0, and d eta naught dt is 1. Oops. Okay, so there we go. And we know the solution to this is that eta naught of t equals sine t. Okay, and Mike, as you said, that appears to be the first term there. Right. Okay, so if we go to order beta, then we get, so my chalk broke. So you have to substitute the expansion in your head in here. You're going to get eta 1 here, eta 1 here, and beta times d eta naught dt when you collect terms at order beta. Okay, so d squared eta 1 dt squared plus eta 1, and I'll throw it to the other side, minus d eta naught dt. And then the initial conditions become eta 1 of 0 is 0, and d eta 1 dt of 0 is 0, right? Because we expand this, right? First term d eta, oh, sorry, where is it? This is d eta naught dt plus beta d eta 1 dt. This is 1 plus, you know, 0 epsilon, or beta rather, sorry, epsilon. Okay, so that's the problem we have to solve in order 1, and the solution here is eta 1 of t equals negative t over 2 sine t. So if we put it back together, so eta naught plus beta eta 1, we indeed recover this. And we can see that this, as Mike said, this regular perturbation expansion is trying to reconstruct the small beta Taylor series of the exact solution. So it's not completely wrong, but it's not useful. It's not useful as an asymptotic approximation when t is of order 1 on beta. Why not? Because, well, when t is order 1 on beta, this term is order 1 as beta goes to 0, which is as big as this term, right? So we don't have terms getting smaller in the expansion, okay? Someone asked Daniel about renormalization group theory. And so it's here, I think, again, and I guess we have Nigel, so we'll ask him. But it's here that when one carries out the regular perturbation expansion, which requires no sort of tremendous insights or about rescalings, right? You just do it. You then can do renormalizing based on what you're finding here. Okay. So, I mean, already this is suggesting, if I did, let's say I did not know the exact solution, I did not know the Taylor series of the exact solution, but I just did this, right? I would get to this point, and I would say, okay, so this is sine t minus beta t onto sine t, you know, hopefully plus order beta squared or something, as beta goes to 0, with t fixed. But I could say, yeah, but I really care about the behavior of this system for large time, and I'd be nervous that when time is going like 1 on beta, this term's not small compared to that one. Again, no proofs of anything here, but just looking for some kind of consistency checks. And so, but then at the same time, that failure tells me something about how to fix things, right? Because the idea is that we are either inspired by this observation, that that's what's causing us problems when t is order 1 on beta, or we're inspired by staring at the exact solution over here and thinking, well, for small beta, you know, let's replace nu with 1 here, but keep this exponential intact. That's going to be a pretty darn good approximation to for large time to the true solution. Okay. So either way, we are inspired to do what is called two-timing, to suspend reality where we have one time, lowercase t, and introduce two time scales, as if they're independent variables, both, okay? So the first time scale will, in fact, just be the oscillator time scale that we had at leading order. So it will just be this t. And then we'll need a time scale that captures variation, in fact, the slow damping that occurs on these long time scales, 1 on beta, okay? So again, coming back to sources of non-uniformity, one source was infinite domains, right? So our governing equation, this force is truly small for any given time in this problem. But it's just the slow accumulation of error associated with this term, if you neglected it, that over long enough times, if your domain is long enough in time in this case, that build up and cause order 1 discrepancies. Okay. So with that understanding, we now go back and use the method of multiple scales. Okay. So where am I going to erase? Let's leave that. So what we're going to propose is that we have two times. So we introduce two time scales, or coordinates. I'll call one of them tau, which is just t, and one of them capital T, which will be beta times t. Okay? This one is easy. It's the time scale of the oscillation. This one, I want capital T, or really derivatives with respect to capital T, to be order 1. Okay? So that would mean that derivatives with respect to lowercase t are order 1 on beta, are weak. Okay? So the way we can see this is we set eta of t and beta equal to, I think I called it capital N, of tau t and beta. And then we need to know the chain rule, right? So d eta d t equals the partial of n with respect to tau. D tau dt is 1 plus the partial of n with respect to capital T. D capital T d little t is beta. Right, so I'm going to insist that these things are, these derivatives are order 1 because I've done the rescaling. But the weakness of the slow time is because this is small. This beta is small. Okay, so that's what d eta dt is. Of course, we need the second derivative, so, you know, you do this twice. Oops. Acting on that. And now the procedure is as follows. We've made our ansatz, right? We're going to write the exact governing equation, but with the multi-scale time derivatives, i.e. doing this. And same with the initial conditions. We're going to have a multi-scale data here, or initial condition here. And then we posit an expansion for n, which now depends on these two times, tau and t plus beta eta 1, of tau and t plus blah, blah, blah. So let's go ahead and, so actually, that's probably the hardest part if you've never seen this before. And again, most of you have, but if you haven't, are there any questions on maybe the motivation for certain steps? Because the rest is almost turning the crank. Okay? So. Maybe I'll be nice and write it out. Okay, so our PDE with respect to n, before I even expand n, is this. It's negative beta 2 d by dt of d by dt. Good. I'm going to just write this one term, and there's more. Go ahead.
Would you be at all tempted to put in a third time, beta
square t? Sure. One can put in a hierarchy of slow time scales. Sometimes one has to. I think Hinch makes this nice point that when there are truly different physical processes acting on different time scales, so the inertia balancing, the spring, you know, and then damping from the damper, you know, use different time scales. But when you're tweaking a frequency, sort of straining the coordinate is a more efficient way of doing that. But you'd get to the same end state here.
So I posted this chapter from Hinch on the asymptotics page.
Great. So I think Hinch is a fantastic book to use. It's concise, but it does help if you already sort of have some idea about the topic. So I would argue, I took a course of graduate school on asymptotic methods. We used Bender and Orszag, a classic book. First of all, they don't treat PDEs. Second of all, it felt like, maybe ODEs feels when you take it as an undergrad, a grab bag of different tricks. What I really appreciated about Hinch's small monograph is it lent a unity to the whole of the subject, so it didn't feel so much like guesswork.
skips a lot of steps. I'm trying to teach from them. You have to fill in a lot of details yourself when you try to teach other towns.
So let me just write this out. I won't write every last step of everything I do today, of course, but at the beginning, maybe I'll be pedantic. Okay, so let's see if we believe these terms. We're getting a beta and a beta squared term from that. That must be this guy and that guy. And then these two terms must come from here. Okay. So that's our problem. We then substitute our, so what did we do? We took our exact equation, just rewrote it using the two time scales, which makes it look like our problem is harder because this was an ODE and now we have a PDE, so that seems like we're making life miserable. Have I screwed something up? Yes.
I might be wrong with this, but is the last term the right to have a
plus? I'm sure it's a plus.
Yeah, it's a plus.
And also,
because there's a minus there. Thank you. No, because I'm just expanding this term, which is, let me write it. So dA to dt is dA to d tau plus beta dA to d slow t.
The cross term in order of beta.
Say again?
There's a cross term in order of beta.
Yeah. But it's here.
Yeah.
That's from the second derivative. Yeah. Okay. Other questions? No. Okay. So great. So now we substitute our expansion in here and collect terms at like order. So at order one, we have d squared tau n naught plus n naught equals zero. Don't forget we have to expand the initial conditions as well. So we're going to get n naught of, now we have to be a little careful, n naught is a function of tau and capital T, right? When the original T is zero, they're both zero. So we have n naught of zero comma zero is zero. And then we have to expand this guy, which I just wrote a second ago and erased. So d eta dt plus beta d eta d capital T, that's what this is going to be, right? Evaluated at zero, zero. But don't forget we also substitute the expansion for n in here. So I should have written n. Called that tau, sorry. Right, so I'm going to collect terms at order one and just get that dBd tau of n naught 0, 0 is 1. So that is my order one problem. Okay? We can write down this solution straightforwardly. And we get, I'll write it using complex exponentials. That was going to be my initial condition at some point. Sorry. Thank you, Daniel.
Great. Can you go back up to the top equation? That results from putting this, double the capital N, substituting that back.
No. That's what I'm trying to emphasize.
Where does this come from?
This comes from simply replacing.
Yeah.
This eta was a function only of T. It was an ODE. We have replaced eta with a function of two times, tau and capital T. And so we do the chain rule. And
okay, so but my question is, what motivates you to, I'm trying to track the...
the terms?
What motivates you to put things on the left and the right-hand side, like some of those?
Sorry.
And you just point out which terms come from which parts of that equation and why you ordered it.
Sorry. This comes from, let me do it this way, double dot is eta, okay? This comes from eta. This one comes from eta double dot. This one comes from eta dot. I'll put the beta there so you know it's a damping term. This one is eta double dot. And this one is beta eta dot. So at the moment, there's no real pattern there, right, in terms of the physics. No, I'm just grouping things that are small compared to order one.
Oh, okay. You've got one beta and beta squared. Yeah. That's your...
So at leading order, clearly all this stuff's going away because my expansion starts at order one. That'll all be small, and we're back to, we're perturbing off a linear harmonic oscillator.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And, right, okay. So we have the solution. The thing is, the solution, this is a PDE, right? It's got, it's a n-naught as a function of tau and capital T. Okay. So I've written down the general solution once I allow these quote-unquote constants of integration to depend on slow time. Okay. And you can always check. So you take that and stuff it in there, do your partial derivatives with respect to tau holding capital T fixed, and it satisfies the leading order PDE. But capital T is just carried along as a parameter. Okay, but you have to allow this amplitude to depend on slow time. Now, that might make us nervous. In fact, what might make us nervous originally is that how are we going to determine the slow time dependence? You know, we know that we only have one time in reality, but we've suspended reality and put in two times. How are we going to determine the slow time dependence of n? Well, we're going to use the flexibility that we have to kill any sort of forcing that would lead to resonant growth or secular growth of our expansion. We want to keep our expansion well-ordered, uniform. So I'm just going to leave that as is for now and go to next order. Okay. So at order beta, and John, getting back to your comment, notice we have the same linear operator showing up. What am I doing? Equals. Okay, so we have the same linear operator on the left. Now I need the order beta terms on the right. So it's minus 2 dBd slow time of dBd fast time of n naught, right? And then plus, or minus rather, dBd tau of n naught. Make sure that agrees with what I've written. Okay? There are some ICs, I won't write them down, because it turns out we won't need them unless we wanted to calculate our approximation. I lost a subscript 0 there, I'm sorry. I'm only going to get this leading order term, but I'm going to insist that this leading order term be a good approximation even for times out to order 1 on beta. Okay? But if I wanted to get this term, then I actually need to roll up my sleeves and, you know, impose these initial conditions. So I'm not going to worry about that. Okay, so here we have this. Okay, so we take this and bang it in there and there. So we get minus 2i dA dt e to the I tau minus I a e to the I tau plus complex conjugate. Okay? Just by taking this and putting it in there. And in essence, we're right at the same point that we were at with the regular perturbation expansion. That is, there was a term on the right-hand side that was causing trouble because it was forcing, basically, this first-order correction at the frequency of this oscillator, at frequency 1. Okay? And you can see it right here. E to the I tau, E to the I tau. That's going to cause problems for this guy, and it's going to cause growth of N1, meaning N1 would be proportional to tau e to the I tau or something along those lines. But don't forget, you know, when we come back here, that would be beta tau e to the I tau. And that's bad, because tau is lowercase t. And then when t is 1 on beta, this term would be as big as that one. So that's exactly what we don't want. That's exactly what we don't want. So we're going to choose dA dt, the slow time behavior of A, to, if we can, kill these evil terms, the so-called secular resonant forcing terms.
So I see these initial conditions in your order one approximation.
Yep.
And so if we weren't doing this, I'd just solve for these A's.
Oh, yeah, you'd impose these.
Right.
So we can.
Doing that.
Well, you can try to impose them, but you won't.
It won't work.
No, it just won't tell you everything. So we'll do that in a moment anyways, but you'll see that.
It gives you A at t equals 0.
Right.
It doesn't tell you
It doesn't
a
tell you the rest of the A's.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, thank you. But we'll do that in a moment. Okay, so I can see that half the audience is either asleep or already knows this, so we're almost done with our simple example one. So the idea is we pick you know, group the E to the I tau terms and pick, so choose dA dt equal to negative A on 2. Is that what I want to do? So that this term cancels that one. Right, all the terms proportional to e to the I tau are gone. The complex conjugate will take care of itself once you do this. And that is our so-called amplitude equation for A, how A varies slowly in time. Okay, so we can write down the answer very easily. So A of t equals A, I don't know, naught or A of 0, e to the negative t on 2. So now we can come back to these initial conditions. And so what's a little bit interesting is we need the order one initial conditions here. So at order one, our initial conditions, ICs, gave us that n naught of 0 and 0 is A of 0. So where's n naught here? Okay, so A of 0 plus A star of 0. And then dBd tau of n naught 0 comma 0 gives us I times A of 0 minus A star of 0 has to equal 1. Sorry if you can't see that. Right, I'm just taking the tau derivative, which brings down an I and a negative I, setting capital T in lowercase and tau to 0, and saying that it's got to equal 1 because that initial speed. Okay, so you put those together and you find out what A of 0 is. A of 0 is negative I on 2. Okay, so I now know what this thing is. And then if I come back to my leading approximation, I now know what A of t is, right? And so when the dust clears, we get that n naught of tau and t is sine tau e to the negative t on 2, or eta, going back to eta of t, is asymptotic to sine tau e to the negative beta t on 2. And that agrees well with what we thought we should do with our exact solution.
So something special here that you got it exactly with...
Oh, it's not exact.
Not exact.
Right, why is it not exact? It's because there's some extra things here. And I think Rich was asking about... Yeah. So you would need another time scale, as Rich said, or coordinate straining. But we don't. I just want to illustrate that. You know, again, I don't know what people know and don't know. So, okay. So questions on the algorithm? Yes.
I don't know a lot, so I'll ask questions.
Great. Except about rapidly rotating.
Yeah. You choose the ADT. So in a sense, you kind of have an intuition for how the ADT looks like.
No, I had no bias, you know, I didn't, no insider knowledge on this problem. It's just I'm nervous when I get here for this correction term,
yes.
Right? Even though in the expansion, you know, this is order one, this is beta small, but I'm nervous, is this guy for all tau and, you know, t going to be well behaved, okay? And so I look at the equation for N1, the correction, if you will. And I'm nervous because on the right-hand side, when I substitute my leading order solution, I have, you know, if this were just an oscillator problem, I'm forcing at the resonant frequency, frequency 1.
Yeah.
So that's what I was saying, is that would cause, if I wrote, I should have written N1, to be not just e to the I tau, but you'll get a term that's like linear in tau. So then when you put it back in here, when you substitute N1 here, you'd have beta times tau, and then you're in trouble again. I mean, that's exactly how the regular perturbation failed. So even without any kind of deep understanding of the physics of this or something, it just, that came out.
Yeah. Formally, yes. you say that the right-hand side has to be, it can't be in the range of the left.
Okay, so you're just getting ahead, Mike. Yes, okay.
There's a formal condition.
Yeah, so that's why I have a second example involving pattern formation from PDEs, because, you know, it's all well and good with oscillators and things just to look for e to the I tau and say that's the troublemaker. When you're dealing with PDEs, it is more complicated, and then you definitely need the formal machinery of solubility conditions and Fred Holm alternative and adjoints being orthogonal to the, or sorry, null adjoint vectors being orthogonal to the right-hand side. But I was going to go through all that in the context of pattern formation. Yeah, I'll work from right to left. Yes. Sorry, Joe.
So beta is small in this problem, and so we have a slow time and a fast time. Is there anything in the analysis that says how small beta needs to be so that it separates your small and fast times?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, that's that hard question of how small does your small parameter have to be for the approximation to be good? And that's notoriously a difficult question without doing things rigorously, which becomes challenging when you're talking about Navier-Stokes.
It needs to be less than 2.
Yeah, I was going to say, right. So, if you're an asymptoticist, you cite all these examples where your small parameter epsilon can be 1, and it still works. And that's Stefan Ladize, because he always does WKB problems, and man, it doesn't matter, he just gets great agreement no matter what. On the other hand, the problems that I've decided to, torture myself with, there are logarithms and things like that, and the small parameter probably needs to be a lot smaller than I want it to be, So I don't know, I don't have any good answer for that. Where was Jeff?
At each step, you end up getting before the sort of PD, and that is, am I correct in understanding that's because you chose your slow time scale correctly? In terms of, I could put beta squared there or beta. Right?
So let's say you chose this, you mean? So beta squared or something?
Or
something else. I think you would always still get at leading order effectively an ODE. I don't think you would mess that up because you're introducing terms that are small, no matter how you scale that within reason. Right, so the slow t is going to appear parametrically. Is that?
Normally you want the zeroth order equation to be something that you can solve easily.
Yeah.
So if it's a PDE, normally it's not so easy to solve easily.
Yes, Brad.
So when you go from one time to two time, I always have this nagging feeling that there's like some overcounting going on. They're tied together there. But can you do this by doing a Fourier transform in frequency space and having a low pass and a high pass, dividing up big T would be the things that are Fourier transformed over the low frequencies give you a big T dependence, and the high frequencies give you the tau dependence. Could you make a precise separation this way, or?
I don't know. That feels like GQL and our discussions that led to GQL.
What is that?
Sorry. Generalized quasi-linear approximation.
Yeah.
It's a very good question. And I does anyone have any?
Well, I mean, this, my
you comment, can do that.
What is the word that if beta is not small, it looks like you're off?
It's just you replace this function of one variable with a function of two variables, so that just looks like a strange operation.
But then you're following a line. I mean, you go from one time to two times, and you follow a specific line.
Yeah.
Or that capital T equals beta T. So that's where the total derivative results along that line. I just understood that for the first time when he did this. So now you go to two variables, but you differentiate along a specific path.
There's some art, and sometimes they're at some points in the calculation we have these two times that are kind of varying independently, and then so there's some art to picking when you set them.
More than that, because you're taking then dv tau and dv t, and you're taking them as different quantities. Otherwise, they will always be linked, and you cannot break them apart.
Yeah, you have to break. Thank you. You have to break them, otherwise you're not doing.
So
multiple.
It's not really this.
This is a true statement. The tau is beta t.
Well, yeah, of course,
but you're right.
Think of it that
way. You're exactly right. That I mean, you have to, if you're going to play this game, you're going to have to treat tau and t and derivatives with respect to tau and capital T rather as independent. Because if you didn't, then, I mean, then.
I want you to keep in mind that you've got control on the beta. So you can change beta winner the way you want. So that makes the two time scales independent with respect to beta. That's how I would do it. If you take a fixed value of beta, you're going to get yourself in all sorts of trouble. If you make the beta to be this sort of variable that you can vary, that's an accused of things.
But in terms of the equation, you're really just solving it for a particular beta. Are you saying you're thinking of solving it over some parameter space?
Yeah. You're always talking about solving the equation with variable beta. As soon as you have one value, you're in all sorts of trouble. You're trying to solve the equation without really specifying what beta is.
But when you manipulate the equation, you treat beta as a constant.
Yeah, but what you want to do is see, that's how you, otherwise you can't separate the orders.
It's a parameter, yeah.
So if you solve the equation with a given value of beta, you want your solution to also be valid. If you don't, of course, things start to move apart. So that's how you have to separate what depends on beta and what depends on different powers of beta. That's why there's a separation by keeping beta as variable, but small.
You really want to think that of another way of saying that is you're embedding your one problem with its particular value of beta or Reynolds number or whatever into a family of problems. And for some reason, you know, solving that family is easier, or approximating the solution to that family is easier than.
So you're kind of like lifting it to a larger dimensional space.
Yeah, although we're not differentiating with respect to beta.
Yeah.
I think that the problem is that this is an asymptotic expansion. Asymptotic expansion means you fix t and you let beta go to zero.
Right.
This is not a serious expansion where you take beta and say, okay, I will add more term and they will eventually converge. This is never going to converge, or doesn't have to converge. If letting beta go to zero, your solution goes to something that makes sense. It's different from a serious expansion.
But in your first slide, you essentially said it does have to converge.
No, that's not true.
The thing I tried to write over there.
Yeah,
no, that was for fixed number of terms, right?
And
then letting the parameter beta or epsilon go to zero.
And this most of the thing, if you let z go long enough, you run into this fact that you haven't fixed the.
That's right, adjusted the frequency.
Okay.
But we could work harder.
But it's beta goes to zero.
Yes, Daniel.
Wait forever before there.
Yes.
The magic. I'm not sure if this is useful for other people, but the way that I think about it is that so you have that t is equal to tau plus beta big T, right? And tau and t are both order one, like not order beta, right? So if you fix that tau and big T have to be order one, and then you're looking at times up to 1 over beta, then I think it's well defined. Then there's a kind of a unique way to pick tau and big T for every value of little t up to 1 over beta. And then once you go past 1 over beta, if you go to times of 1 over beta squared, well, that's exactly when the fact that your frequency isn't 1, it's actually square root of nu, is going to cause more problems.
So just the prospects for fixing that up with higher order terms to get closer to the good solution are good or bad.
Good.
Good.
Yeah, I mean, so one way to do it is to, as Rich had said, would I be tempted to introduce, sorry, that's beta, another slope, so we'll call this T1. Could I have a T2 and a T3, right, and to capture?
How would you think to do that? Would that be a beta squared?
That's a hope. I mean, you're not guaranteed at all that putting more term will help.
Right.
The only thing that helps is getting better small.
For linear problems,
I think there are results that would say keep adding more time, slow times.
Yeah.
So you would use beta squared for T2 then, because that would give you a bigger time, essentially? Is that how logic?
No, I mean, because you will not be able to cancel the secular terms for the next term, beta 1, without beta squared.
Right.
Yeah. So you'd have to introduce it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you would go down to the next order and find out that you had a problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You'd be there.
Okay, good. Okay. So I don't know what people want to do. You can break because people have things to do. We can do a matched asymptotics example. We can do a pattern formation example. I can talk to you about fissures. You know, well, I can't do that without telling you a little.
Pattern formation things will go down to the
Yes.
I bet for pattern formation.
I think
that'll
be fun.
Yeah?
Okay.
At least it's one topic then. So, yes, please. Can I erase or no? This. This is not taught in the undergraduate curriculum. No, it's not even taught in, it's not taught in the mathematics department either. It's certainly not taught in any undergraduate.
But I'm not even
I'm sure Charlie Yorin learned this in like eighth grade.
Well, Charlie always says, that, Charlie always talks about, you know, junior high boundary value problems.
I'm not even sure it's taught
in the
curriculum.
In a graduate mathematics course.
Yes.
Fourth year, hold on. Wait, you take, is your, does your department do this?
I like to implement
the fourth year.
No, you, oh, so you had this math.
Yeah. Why taught this before?
It's not in the U.S.
Okay, so this would be a graduate course.
It would not exist in general. Well, no, what you say, I'm old.
Mike.
I know, but when I was young, it was not taught in math departments at all. I went to MIT Applied Math, where Orsay was writing this book based on this groundbreaking class.
I have liked to do that.
All right.
So yes.
Taught an undergraduate.
In France, you start an undergraduate? Anyway, we also have space-time problem, you know, at different time. I mean, my curriculum is not the same as younger people's.
You've gotten to a different teacher, a better grade here, John?
Is that the way it works in New Hampshire?
You probably require more. Good start, though.
Is this being filmed?
What do I get to break?
Is this being filmed?
It is.
Yes.
So please respect university.
So Mike, I don't know if you just heard of it. When do you teach multiple time series? What a graduate elective class?
In department what?
I taught it once in chemical engineering, but the probably in math, it's going to mostly be in like the advanced, it's going to be in a topics class for fluid mechanics. I'm not even sure if we have a whole asymptotics class in the math department.
Molly teaches it in junior.
But I don't think this is a question then about curriculum.
Wally's junior level advanced calculus class is pretty intense. Yeah.
It's particularly if you're going to impose it. If you're asking about the general curriculum, then you don't need to ask about their institutions, what they themselves are teaching, since they chose to do that. I have confirmation from a younger person that it's not taught at all.
Or in general,
it's taught at all. Well, I learned some aspects of this in completely different language in dynamics. When same class we learned about chaos, some of this was in it, but we did the two timing and we do.
Center manifold is a different way to get.
No, center manifold was
a
completely different.
The transformation in normal forms you can get to from two timing. Where's Edgar?
The normal forms is what we did. In my time. But that was in a second dynamics class. Five math departments. Caltech, MIT, Brown, and
I don't mean to commit to the ultimate social code part, but a lot of this stuff is actually only developed in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. So passing through into the undergraduate syllabus takes a while.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Why is this a faux pas?
One never makes any comment that has any relevance to one's age.
I see, but how is that relevant to one's age?
Well, because
Okay.
One more comment. At Cornell, Richard Rand taught this in TAMS, the
Leathers. But that's a graduate course.
We teach it. Yeah.
I would say in the United...
Some of it in both here, but the thing is that our courses are so specialized. You know, you're doing math from 15?
I would say in the United States, it's either taught in graduate school in whatever department. Maybe it's math, maybe it's a special topics course in mechanical engineering or civil. Or it's not taught at all. Right. It's not required. It's classic. As I said, I was a dinosaur, right?
Who needs it?
But the problem is, we are at our peril losing these techniques because Wally had to figure out or think about how to do critical layer analysis on a non-planar critical layer, and you know, Phil Hall did it instead. And now we're interested in patterns reemerging in turbulent regimes, you know. So these techniques, you know, still have some merit.
Well, Cambridge will keep training them, I think, until
time. Okay. Well, Cambridge is a special.
Yeah, and we only got introduced to it, and that course is gone.
Okay. So porous medium convection is a nice, simple setting to talk about the method of multiple scales as applied to patterns and mathematically in the context of partial rather than ordinary differential equations. So here's the setup. We have two horizontal plates. We heat from below, so I don't know why. Thank you. We heat from below, cool from above, okay? And instead of having liquid or something in here, pure liquid, we actually have a porous material that's saturated with a fluid like water or something, okay? So basically, the dynamics, if you will, in here, we're going to take to be governed by Darcy's law. So the pressure velocity is proportional to the pressure gradient, but we'll include a buoyancy force through the Boussinesq approximation. Okay, so that really reduces the complexity of what we're going to see. The only nonlinearity in the problem comes from the advection diffusion equation for the temperature. Okay, so if we write this in stream function form, we get del squared psi is negative. This is a Rayleigh number, our parameter in the problem. This is a torque, a buoyancy torque. And this is advection diffusion. That's Jacobian. Okay, everyone.
Subscript means derivative.
Yeah, although I'm probably being. I don't know if I'm going to stick with that. So let me avoid new notation. Sorry. Thank you.
And in your box down
did
there.
Did I do
that,
something?
That doesn't mean derivative.
This is derivative. Derivative.
Oh, your lower box.
Oh, the B.
Yeah.
No, that's just basic.
Oh, base. Sorry.
Nothing more. To, yeah. We had beta on the brain from last last problem.
Do you have X or Z for the non-direction?
I have Z for the G. X is horizontal. Z, no Y's in this problem.
And then the derivative is dx other than Z.
Sure, it's a buoyancy torque, right? You need differences.
Yeah.
Hot and cold fluid. Yeah.
It's because you took the.
I took the curl. Yeah. Okay, so. All right, so we have a simple solution to this problem that's conduction with no flow, so psi is zero, temperature is 1 minus E, and we can look at, for example, the stability of that solution using standard techniques. And let me just cut to the chase and say if we write, let's just record some key results from linear stability before looking at the weakly nonlinear problem, linear stability results. Okay, so... We could say that psi and, I didn't rewrite the equation, so I should do that. So if we take this, where's that, that decomposition, put it in here, this becomes theta, this becomes theta, this becomes theta. I got to put another term somewhere. So I get minus d psi dx, let me write it out, plus del squared theta. So just to identify, there's your nonlinear terms. This is vertical velocity W. Do I have the sign wrong? No, I'm nervous. No, because d temperature, dt basic dz is negative 1. So that's what that term is, vertical advection of that background temperature field. Okay, so psi and theta, we're going to make a normal mode on sots. Basically, Fourier transform in x, and time, So e to the I kx, e to the sigma t plus complex conjugate. So you take this, stuff it into that problem, and what you find out is that the growth rate sigma, I can save some time, actually. Let me write one more line. One nice thing about this problem, we can do everything analytically. The vertical basis functions end up being sine of m pi z. So this is going to be psi hat sine m pi z and theta hat. Well, I guess I could have done it this way, sorry. Theta hat. These don't depend on z anymore. So we have sine m pi z, e to the I kx, e to the sigma t plus complex conjugate. Okay, sorry. So maybe you can believe that if you think about the derivatives in z and the boundary conditions, et cetera. Okay, but it's one thing that makes the problem nice. We can work everything out analytically. Okay, so now what I was going to say was that the growth rate you find equals k squared times the Rayleigh number over k squared plus m pi squared minus k squared plus m pi squared. Okay. So that's the growth rate of small disturbances obtained by assuming we can linearize this system for small psi, small theta. Okay, and we can find that the so-called marginal stability curve by setting sigma equal to 0 and m equal to 1, let's say 4m equals 1, yields marginal stability curve. Okay, so the Rayleigh number as a function of k equals pi squared plus k squared over k squared, and it's this quantity squared, sorry. So if we make a plot, here's the Rayleigh number, here's the wave number, and we can plot this thing. I don't know, something like that. And the point is, sigma equals 0 right on this curve. That defines that curve, sigma equals 0, and m equals 1. Yes?
Right. Isn't there a minus before the n pi squared on the...
Oh, that was a brackets. Couldn't you see the brackets?
These are brackets.
Thank you. Okay.
What about the Rayleigh number? Can you double check that?
It's k squared times Rayleigh.
For the Rayleigh number.
Sorry, I don't understand.
Because that's k squared over dimensionless.
Yeah, everything is dimensionless. That is correct. So I'll check one page before, but yeah, that's right. Okay. So this is our marginal stability boundary. So sigma is less than 0 down here. Sigma is greater than 0 up there. Lovely. So this is a K critical, and this is Rayleigh critical. Rayleigh critical is 4 pi squared, and it occurs for modes with m equals 1 and k critical equals pi. Okay, so that's that point right there. So what we would like to do is ask what happens to these, you know, as we crank up the Rayleigh number, you know, disturbances are damp, until we get to 4 pi squared, then assuming we can... our domain, say, is infinitely wide, we can accept modes of any wave number. If k pi, if there are disturbances with k equal to pi, they are neutrally stable. They're marginally stable, okay? And then we would like to know what happens as we crank up the forcing. So let's say we put the forcing up to here. Then from the picture, at least, you know, again, in an infinitely wide domain, any modes with wave numbers between here and here could go unstable. Okay, and you might ask, what's the fate of the pattern? What's the fate of the instability? So I'm going to call this distance the difference between the actual Rayleigh number, I'll put it down here, and the critical Rayleigh number. Let me just call that delta, say, k. capital delta, and then this range of wave numbers here, I'm going to call lowercase delta. Now, that looks big, but of course, we're going to perform an approximation. So what is our small parameter? Fundamentally, it's going to be, in a weakly nonlinear problem like this one, the closeness of the actual Rayleigh number, the control parameter in the problem, to the critical value. So I can adjust my experiment and dial the actual Rayleigh number down as close as I want to RA critical. Okay. And then this is becoming small, right? So we would like to develop a weakly nonlinear theory, you know, that tells us about how things evolve. So for the Rayleigh number close enough to RA critical. So for RA equals RA critical times 1 plus a delta times R with delta going to 0. Okay, so there's some observations. One is that if we just look at the growth rate expression over here, say with m equal to 1 and k near critical, you know, so we're going to have that k is say k critical plus some delta times capital K order 1. So we're the k's that we allow, the modes that we expect to go unstable and be involved in the dynamics, are close to k critical. Okay. So just by looking at the growth rate expression, the linear physics, which is what we're perturbing off here clearly, just by looking at that expression, we can find out, convince ourselves that sigma, the growth rate, must be of order delta, as delta goes to 0. So I'm not going to go through that argument, but it's just from there. The next thing, you know, okay, why is that important? Sorry. That's important because, you know, if delta is truly a small parameter, that is, if RA is close to RA critical, this implies that, and this is the growth rate, right? We have e to the sigma t. You know, this implies a very slow growth. So we're motivated to introduce a slow time scale. Now, if our instability were, if we had a Hopf bifurcation, we might have a fast time scale and a slow time scale, like the problem I just did. But here, you know, the bifurcation is steady, so we really don't have any fast time scale. We just have a slow time scale. So this motivates introducing a slow time, T, not to be confused with temperature, capital T, but that's gone, right? So we just have theta now. So this is suggests that T should be delta times little t, so that d by d little t equals d by d big T d little t is delta. So I want these time derivatives with respect to big T to be order 1. And in terms of the actual time scale, the way I non-dimensionalized, you know, we have variability on this slower time scale order delta. So again, the challenge in asymptotics is adducing the scaling. You know, where did the scalings come from? So in a weakly nonlinear problem like this, you can learn a lot by just studying the linear dispersion relation or growth rate. So that's where that comes from. That's a temporal rescaling. But if we think about space, again, I'm considering we're in an infinitely wide domain. Okay, so we can have modes of any wave number, but the wave numbers that we allow are very close to a certain value, kc. We all know from Fourier synthesis that if we superpose a bunch of modes that have wave numbers that are close to each other, we can get beating type patterns, and so we might expect modulation of the resulting dynamics, certainly if it were just linear physics, on a long scale. So we're expecting two spatial scales of variability here. In other problems, water wave problems or something, it could be the environment that slowly varies, that imposes some kind of second length scale on the problem. Okay. So, right, so we consider this expression, well, it's probably easiest from here, right? If this curve is locally quadratic near its minimum, right? So locally quadratic near minimum, which it is, then we have that delta, which measures how far we are in terms of k from kc, must be of order the square root of capital delta, where that one's telling us the distance from criticality in terms of the forcing. Okay. Why is this important? This is going to tell us something about introducing multiple spatial scales, in particular slow spatial scales. Okay. So from this, we're inspired to have, we have to allow for two spatial scales now, right? Because our fundamental pattern of convection had wave number kc, which is order one in terms of Rayleigh number. Okay. So we have chi as our fast scale, if you like, fast spatial scale. That's order, that equals x. And then capital X, say, is going to be our slow spatial scale, which is going to equal delta times little x, if I did this right. But of course, delta, I'm saying, is basically square root capital delta times little x. And that one is slow. Okay, so what does that mean in terms of the chain rule? It means that a partial derivative with respect to our original single x coordinate becomes now a partial derivative with respect to chi times the chi dx, which is 1, plus a partial derivative with respect to the capital X times the capital X, the little x, which is delta, which is square root delta. Okay? So this is where, you know, we aren't guessing randomly. I mean, we're guided by some knowledge of the physics of the state that we're perturbing off of in this case. Okay, there's one more quantity that needs to be scaled in a nonlinear problem, that's, or non-homogeneous problem as well, but in particular in a nonlinear problem, we have amplitudes to worry about. Okay, so this one's harder to know ahead of time. Sometimes you just have to try things. But we might ask, you know, we have exponential growth of our mode, albeit on a slow time scale, but it's still growing exponentially. We ask, we hope, you know, does it saturate by through some nonlinearity? And maybe a balance of terms can motivate this. So we're going to have in the equation for theta there, RA minus RAC times theta. And then this is the leap of faith, perhaps. Okay. So what I'm just sort of appealing to some terms that might show up over here. Okay, and so d theta, d t, there it is. There's some nonlinearity that I'm saying, well, you do some stuff and you get a theta cubed term. What about a theta squared? Well, symmetry arguments could tell you that's going to have a zero coefficient. I'd rather not rely on that if you didn't know that ahead of time. You know, you allow for that, you allow that to be delta or theta squared. You go through and you find out some coefficient is zero and you need a different scaling. Yes, Bruno will help me.
No, I'm not going to help you. I'm just going to add. Oh. It's actually about this cubic term because the equation you're starting out with has sort of quadratic coupling. So where does that cubic
term come
from?
Well, you know the answer, of course.
I don't.
Right, so, well, if you can be patient, we will go through this in painstaking detail, because I see the enthusiastic looks in the audience. But the short answer is, first we get the nonlinearity between two modes that go like, where did our mode go? E to the I, K, X, or chi, can give us a mean contribution. So e to the I k times e to the negative I k x can give us a mean in x independent, z dependent, but x independent. And then that term, which arises at second order in our expansion, can multiply, you know, through the nonlinearity, hit a e to the I k x term, right? And then you have a cubic type effect. So it's an adjustment of the mean. Okay. So this is, I have to admit, this is I'm just trying to motivate, okay? So this term we know is of order, well, there's a theta, theta, theta. So we have, I'd like to say that the size of theta is epsilon. I don't know what epsilon is yet in terms of Rayleigh. That's what I ultimately want to know, right? Epsilon in terms of Rayleigh minus Rayleigh critical. So d by dt is order delta, because it's slow. This Rayleigh minus Rayleigh critical is delta. Theta is epsilon, and this would be epsilon cubed. You know, that's if you believe me here. So divide through if we're going to have some kind of balance here. 1, 1, and epsilon squared on delta. Oops, delta, sorry. So that suggests that epsilon, the size of this small amplitude disturbance, might saturate at order square root delta. So if you believe this, we tentatively guess that epsilon is order square root delta. I'd rather work with epsilon than delta, so if you allow me to do it the other way around, I'm going to say delta is order epsilon squared. And then I'll just have epsilons, no more deltas, okay? So now we have the key scalings. I mean, this admittedly is, you'd have to have some inspiration maybe.
Yeah, now, Lorette will tell you that
from
without
symmetry.
Even knowing the equations, you know it's a pitchfork, so you know how the amplitude scales with parameters.
Okay, so if you bring your dynamical systems knowledge into the problem, then you know.
But you still have to know it's a pitchfork.
It's a pitchfork because it's symmetry breaking.
Yeah, I said symmetry.
Okay. Okay. Fair enough.
Okay, so let's just hit the highlights of the analysis. Again, in terms of the pedagogy, it's multiple scales. We have one time scale, but it's a slow scale instead of a fast. But we have two spatial scales. Okay, so we're getting there. Okay, so I'm going to rewrite my RA equals RA critical plus epsilon squared R. That's a lowercase r. Remember, this is 4 pi squared. We're going to posit our expansions. Now we've got two independent fields, theta and psi. So posit that theta, I'll write it out once here. Okay, so this again is I was motivated by the arguments we just made that this epsilon is related to RA minus RAC that way. And we've got the two scales where we've defined, remember, d by d little x equals d by d chi plus epsilon d by d big X. Because it was square root capital delta, which is epsilon. And we can do it twice if we want. And d by dt was epsilon squared d by dt because that was our time scaling capital delta. Okay, so there we go. So we know how to transform things. And John, I'm going to come back to your comment in terms of the algorithm, the steps, right? So we've got some scalings. Before I substitute any expansions, like that one, or one analogous to that for psi, into here, first I'm just going to write this, but with these multi-scale derivatives. So if you let me erase over here. You don't like that?
Oh, we want the equation.
What's that?
We want the equation back.
Actually, you can go for now and I'll plug it in.
I'm good. I'm more worried about the audience, who looks to be tremendously pained.
Yeah, I'd rather have the equations than the picture.
As a parent, the immediate knee-jerk reaction is, then you will get neither.
I just thought it would be useful to relate the equations back to the thing. And then you have more room.
You get the equations, just in a slightly different form.
But the equations he's going to come up with don't look anything like the equation we started with, though.
Right now?
That's the exact equation he started with.
Oh, come on.
No, so far. Now he's changing it.
Okay. We're doing all of this in our heads anyway.
Okay, Toby.
Greg, are you going to put the notes online?
No.
This is never happened.
What's that? That was a serious answer.
I might actually help people, too. Depends on how good this
is. I will. I'm happy to, but, you know, it'll keep you more active if I threaten not to. Okay, so we'll identify terms in a moment, John, to make sure we believe what I'm writing, okay? Oops. Oh, this is painful.
So you're going to find out
the whole J term now? What's that?
So now this is the J term, or you?
Yeah, the temperature equation has the only nonlinearity. So this is not J yet, but we'll get there. Okay, the J term. So dBdz, dBd chi, minus dBd chi of psi, dBdz theta. And then if we have two x derivatives, so we have to do it again. So dBdz of psi. I'm just sorry, Greg. It just trying to think what's easiest. Yeah, let's go to this equation, right? So John, what did we have? We had if you remember, we had del squared psi is negative Rayleigh. Why did I write critical here? Oh, it is right. Okay.
That's because you're still working out. Now you don't know.
No, it's correct. I don't know what's easiest for everyone. Maybe I should rewrite. I'll write. Where did I put it?
That's an epsilon squared r delta.
So let's put a big line there. Okay, sorry. Okay, hopefully that helps. Sorry. Everyone wanted this. Okay, sorry.
Thank you.
You're welcome. See, I can be persuaded.
Have you asked too?
Yeah, I know, many people. Right, so this is the original equation. All I'm doing here, I claim, is rewriting these equations but using multiple scale derivatives for x, anywhere I had, so it's right. And time became slower, and Rayleigh became Rayleigh critical plus epsilon squared. Lowercase r is going to be my knob that I turn. Okay. So again, I would argue, well, direct translation to that. This one is fine when it's RA. I'm throwing all the order one stuff on the left, John. Yeah, that was just like before. And then we have things that are order epsilon. So, you know, when we expand this guy, we get an epsilon term with a mixed derivative and a 2. We also get an epsilon squared term. There it is. When we expand this, because we've got Rayleigh is Rayleigh critical plus epsilon squared, we get a term here. But then we've got two x terms because there's dBd chi and dBd capital X. Okay, and then we have similar down here. Here are the nonlinear terms. Someone was asking about J of psi and theta. Okay, they're there. Okay, so now that's probably the hardest part of this whole thing. Let's go back. I don't need that. So we posited that expansion, a similar one for theta, for psi rather. Okay, and we can write down our problem at order epsilon. Okay, so order epsilon problem is just going to be, you know, that's easy, right? Because you just set epsilon to zero, and your first term, because we're starting off at order one, is theta not or theta one and psi one. Okay, so dBd chi squared plus dBd z squared. Psi 1 plus Ra critical dBd chi of theta 1 equals 0, and dBd chi squared plus dBd z squared theta 1 minus dBd chi of psi 1 equals 0. Remember, we also should expand our boundary conditions. And I don't think I ever wrote them down for theta and psi, but they're homogeneous. So theta is 0, psi is 0, top and bottom.
Right, do these functions have indices 1 or 0?
They have indices 1.
To match epsilon.
To match the epsilons. But maybe that's a matter of taste. So the way I non-dimensionalized my problem, okay, good. So somewhere.
When do you decide that psi was sort of the epsilon?
Right, I didn't write it, but. Well, I think you have it right from here, right? Your leading order, you come over here, or here if you like, right? You have a balance between these terms. So you need this torque that drives the psi, so they're both the same order to start the expansion.
Okay, I guess what Javier's question is pretty much like mine. You could take out one epsilon and it wouldn't change things.
Take out one epsilon and it wouldn't change things. If I take out one epsilon and I come back and substitute it in here, then my leading order problem is fully nonlinear. Right? I mean, I have that T is T basic plus epsilon theta 1. Right? Okay. I mean, I think it is a matter of taste or how you want.
No, this is a solution when this you're weakly nonlinear. So.
I know all I'm acknowledging is one might have non-dimensionalized differently and used different expansion. Sorry, Javier, your question was the psi.
My question was different.
It was about how do I know that psi starts at epsilon also? But you need this balance.
Well, you know that all the dvx is rather 1, but now I see.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Right, okay. So let's also define our linear operator here. So L is going to be dbd chi squared plus dbd z squared. And then what is this? RAC dbd chi. And then dbd chi squared plus dbd z squared. Oh, no. And then negative dbd chi. I think I did that right. So that's our linear operator that will show up over and over on the left-hand side at each order in the expansion, just like in our toy problem. Here it's a boundary value problem. Okay, so our boundary conditions are, and it's part of the operator really, is that theta 1 equals psi 1 equals 0 at z equals 0 comma 1. Okay, so we have the solution to this problem. And maybe I should write it somewhere where I can keep it because we'll need it. Well, that's an I. Okay, that one, I mean, with some arbitrarily chosen normalization, that would be, is a solution to this problem. We already wrote that down. The point is, now, we started with a PDE. We still have a PDE, but we have a PDE in an expanded independent variable space. Because instead of x, z, and t, we have chi, capital X, z, and t. So I need to allow the unknown constant out front to be a function of x and t. And if you don't believe me, right, you just take that, put it in there, take your partial derivatives, and realize that, yeah, that doesn't hurt you at all by allowing that a to vary on the slow x, slow time scale. So that is the general solution to that.
So you always pick your coefficients to vary on the slow whatever thing. So before in the ODE example, when we did the two timing, I mean, I think I remember this from other things, you always pick it to vary on the slow time. I'm just wondering why. If there's sort of a...
Well, I guess ultimately the issue is that I have chosen to sort of zoom in to the fast scale space and time. And so my leading order problem is there.
Right.
And then that forces my hand, right? Because what is the solution, given that I'm looking for functions that depend not just on chi and z, but also on capital X and capital T.
You need to put it there.
You need
to put it there, okay.
I suppose one could have started from a different scale. I don't know how.
Well, but there's a natural scale here, and there's a natural short scale of the problem. That's the that's the size of the roll. So
yeah.
That's what you're working on.
Yeah.
There.
So, okay.
That requires you to know a lot about the problem before you start, right? Because you're saying.
I mean, you know before you start the problem.
Well,
that,
the linear part tells you the problem.
I see.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
Okay, so now, you know, take off the gloves or whatever. We use whatever insights we, you know.
Whatever you have.
Yeah.
That's
numerical solutions to guide you, you know, things like that. Okay, so we have psi 1. Right, so now let's write down the problem at order, because we don't know what this slowly varying amplitude is, just as in the toy problem, so we'd like to determine an equation, evidently a PDE, which will tell me how it varies. So now we go to order epsilon squared. And what do we get? Okay, so now I can just use that notation, I guess, for L. We're going to get the same thing over here with, well, fine, I'll put twos. Two. And this is two and two, right? I'm going to erase that. But on the right-hand side, we no longer have zero. So we have what I will call F2 psi and F2 theta. Those are not derivatives. Those are just to distinguish the, you know, right-hand sides of those two equations. And those come from finding the order epsilon terms over here, right? So this is just tedious, not hard, just pain in the neck. You got to go through and take your leading order solution, stuff it in there, you know, collect the terms at order epsilon. So lo and behold, this one becomes zero. And this one, after lots of tedious algebra, is 4 pi cubed a squared, sine 2 pi z. Okay, let's go to that. Oh. If I did that right. Okay, so now, now we can see that we have a linear system with this, you know, inhomogeneous right-hand side. So we could have a homogeneous solution that's just going to look like a replica of this, right? Possibly with an amplitude you call B or something like that. But the point is, it's just a replica, the homogeneous part. So we can, one way of viewing this is we can absorb that piece into the leading order piece by suitable normalization condition. Okay, so I'm not going to worry about the homogeneous piece. I'm only worried about the inhomogeneous part.
It's really 2 pi z.
Oh, did I screw up? Yes.
I don't know. I'm asking.
Oh, it is 2.
And where did that come from?
Oh, because you have sine pi z's, and you multiply.
That's from the
non-linear. Oh, it's got to be from a nonlinear term, yeah.
Okay, that's right. Okay.
Let me just verify real quick. Yes, it's definitely a nonlinear term in the temperature equation. Which nonlinear term? Okay. I mean, you can see here. You at least have a chance, right?
Yeah, yeah,
beta 1.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Not chance.
It's from the sine cosine, sine times cosine, right? From the.
It's okay.
Yep. There's a sine times cosine, a factor of 2. You write that as sine 2 pi z. You have a question.
Where did time derivatives go?
They're higher order. Did I lose it? And they're here. There.
Okay.
Right, because our bifurcation is steady.
Okay.
But if our bifurcation, again, were a hop bifurcation, you would do two times, you'd have a fast time scale, just like
fast
we.
Time in the linear,
that's right, in the linear operator.
Steady. Hmm. So, okay, we're just trying to find, it's like a small amplitude modulation of linear growth rate.
We're trying to find how. Yes. I don't know about small amplitude modulation. Our disturbance is small.
Sorry.
We haven't yet demonstrated whether it's a supercritical or subcritical bifurcation. Okay, let's say it's supercritical, then for the distance, you know, we're adjusting the control parameter, the delta t, to be close to marginality. So any disturbance that grows, first of all, it's a small disturbance, it's going to grow on a slow time, and we're looking for saturation of that on slow spatiotemporal scales. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Actually, Greg, one question.
Yes.
Is there any primary Hopf bifurcation in this problem?
No.
Okay.
Is there a
primary Hopf bifurcation. Okay. Just to check.
Okay, so we can look for the particular solution, and we can convince ourselves that a particular solution is psi 2 particular is 0, theta 2 particular is, let me do this, negative pi a squared sine 2 pi z. Let's just check real quickly. So 0, the chi derivative of this is 0. No, capital A depends on capital X, but not on the fast scale chi. Okay, so this is fine. And then chi derivatives, again, are 0, psi is 0. And we just have two derivatives in z of this thing are supposed to give us that, which it does, I think, if I didn't. Okay, so what's a little bit frustrating here, unlike the toy problem, is that even though I've gone to second order, I still don't know how A evolves. So I keep my fingers crossed and go to third order. Okay? So let's just record that over here real quickly. Psi 2 p 0 theta.
Quasi saturated.
Yeah. 2 pi z. Okay. Right.
So here you kind of know what you're doing, but how many orders would you typically go to before you decided this is a problem?
Oh. Edgar goes to 5 orders or so, you know, big numbers. I go to 3 and stop.
Rotating convection is 5, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so.
Is that because you have
the old pencil
turns around?
Yeah, all the second order cancel, you know, until fifth order. Then you get an amplitude equation at fifth order. And to determine the direction of bifurcation, you need to go sixth order beyond that. It's quite nasty.
Well, there's a famous story from when already is being recorded. Edgar taught when about the time I was a graduate student, he taught a course and he went out to report back, massive calculation, and at the end, he got zero. And the lesson is you have to go to fifth one.
And you have to be pretty confident that you've picked these things correctly, I guess, if you're going to keep going.
Well, the good news is now you can do all this in like Mathematica and just do it. Like, if you're good at Mathematica, you can do it in like 5 lines. And then you check it yourself by hand. You get zero in Mathematica, you get zero, and then you're pretty sure that's pretty zero. Okay. Oh, I have no idea.
I've done weekly nonlinear mathematics.
Not as good
right,
as...
Right, once you've got the code right, it's great. But
it's pretty painful.
It's pretty painful.
Yeah, I mean, anything that's involved in mathematics is pretty painful.
Has anyone written a package for Mathematica?
To do this?
What was that comment? You do it once for a while, and
then you don't need it anymore. Once you have Swift Thornburg, you're done, right? And this is the global attractor for many of these problems. I mean, no matter where you start, you end up with Swift Thornburg. It's a fancy, it's complex.
Correct.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Okay, so finally we get to the solvability condition and Fredholm alternative, things like this. So we have a linear operator L. We can introduce, for some suitable inner product that here is basically going to be an integration over the x period, 0, 2 pi on k critical, and over the z, so integration over the spatial domain, 0 to 1 in z. We have the usual definition of the adjoint operator. And the point is v1, which is, it's over there, theta 1, psi 1, is in the null space of L, right, because L times v1, or L acting on v1 gives us 0, then there exists a v1 dagger, adjoint v1, such that L plus v1 plus is 0. So that the adjoint operator L plus, to be determined, also is rank deficient. We're just going to make an observation now that if we do the inner product of, so this equation at order epsilon cubed, sorry, I'm writing compactly as linear operator acting on V3 equals F3 right-hand side. So if I take the inner product of this equation with V1, and is that what I mean? I mean V1 dagger, thank you. F3 equals LV3, that was our equation. But by the definition of the adjoint operator, this is V3 inner product with L plus V1 plus. But this is exact. This is 0. Because this, so that means that F3, the inner product of the right-hand side with the null adjoint eigenvector of this linear operator we've defined has to be 0 for us to have a solution to this problem, to this boundary value problem. So F3 inner product V1 plus, that inner product must equal 0 to have a chance of having a bounded solution. And I'm going to skip. Okay, so now we need to go through some exercise to actually work out what the adjoint operator is. I'm going to skip that, okay, and just write down the thank you. I know, everyone's like, can we leave? So the adjoint operator is, let's write it somewhere. So L plus is, it's not self-adjoint, it turns out. Well, maybe you can see it right there that it's not. Dbdi chi squared, oops. Yeah, you flip and sign change. But I did all kinds of integrating by parts to convince myself. Okay, so yeah, we just, okay. So there's the adjoint operator, and then by inspection, having worked out already what the null eigenvector of L is, you just play around a little, usually you can figure out what is the adjoint. So we need V1, I don't know what I'm writing.
Sign,
I
think we just checked sign domain, V1.
Yeah, yep. Well, so V1 equals, how do I write it? Psi is on top, so psi 1 plus, this is plus, theta 1 plus, equals 1 and then negative I 2 pi. And then sine pi z e to the I kc x plus complex conjugate. Okay. So we have the adjoint, right? And so with that adjoint in hand, this coming back to your question, how do you know, we're almost there. Is that a question, or your wrist is hurting from all the writing?
I just said you were getting all money's worth.
I don't know. All right, we'll take a poll afterwards. Denise, coming back to your question. I mean, you know, here, rather than trying to sort of fully solve this problem to work out psi 3 and theta 3, I'm just going for the jugular, right? I just would like to get my amplitude equation so I can go home for A. Okay, so all I'm going to do at this point in the analysis is say, right, I got to work out the right-hand sides here, and then I have to hit the right-hand side with V1 plus, which is this guy, right? And I have to ensure, if I'm going to have any chance of solution, that it's 0, okay? So that's going to help me strategically zoom, you know, zero in on the terms that could cause problems. That's the idea.
Doesn't
yes.
Your right-hand side come from those equations?
It does, absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. Sorry. Yeah. So I go through. I mean, there are no shortcuts here, I don't think, except automating it via, you know, symbolic algebra routines. But you know, to work out F3, this is not magic, right? We go back to the right-hand sides over here, collect terms at order epsilon cubed, so you have to be careful to make, you know, with the bookkeeping, the accounting, right? Something simplified, I mean, psi 2 is 0, psi theta 2 only depends on z, you know, that helps you, okay. But the other point to bear in mind is that when you do this inner product, this v1 goes like, you know, e to the plus or minus ikc, right? So I'm really looking for things in F3, terms in F3, that also go like e to the plus or minus ikc, so that there's a chance that, at least in terms of the x integration that's implied with this inner product, that I get a 1. Because if I get, you know, just e to the I, 2 pi, or 2kc, whatever, I'm just going to integrate to 0 in x. So I can save a little time that way by strategically identifying. But the difference with the ODE situation, because that sounds a lot like, oh, just find those secular terms like we did with the oscillator problem. But the difference is we also are projecting in z, right? I mean, so let's say you find a term, you know, that in terms of x, this is e to the plus, e to the minus I k chi, and this is e to the I plus k chi, so that in x you get a 1, you integrate, you're not getting 0. But you still have to integrate the z part out and get something non-zero to have a problem, right? So you just have to, you know, sort of turn the crank. And here's where I have to, obviously, strategically, oh boy. Yep, we're just going to. I'm going to keep putting them down. Yeah.
But you are giving us these.
So I am giving you. Yes, because you've been nice. Right, I don't know. Can I erase the equations? We don't need them anymore.
No. How come I can't erase the equations? I'm not commenting.
It's probably due to the.
Yeah, I shouldn't have erased. I at least wanted to point out the nonlinear term that caused problems, which I've now. Okay. Yep. Wrong reg. Yeah, okay. So obviously there are more steps to go through to, you know, and it's a bit painful, but I don't know that it takes a lot of intelligence. It's just trigger. So but we can at least stare at the result. And make sure we understand a couple things, right? Remember, it's this we need for solvability. Otherwise, we have a badly ordered perturbation expansion, right? We have a badly ordered perturbation expansion if this doesn't hold. And therefore, terms that are non-zero are the troublemakers, right? But we can suppress those terms by appropriately specifying the slow spatiotemporal evolution of A. That's where this comes from, just like in the toy problem that I did. And so it's a little more involved, but there you go. This pops out. And we might make some observations here. So comment number one is A is complex. Right? So this is really two equations for two real fields, the magnitude of the complex amplitude and the phase. And that has to do with sort of quote-unquote symmetries of the problem, or, you know, near threshold, the amplitude is arbitrary. Right, so you can sort of change your problem by shifting the amplitude a little, you still have a solution. But you also have translational, you know, you can shift the problem, the roles left to right, and that would also be a solution, a continuous translational symmetry. So that's really where these two amplitude equations are coming from. And of course, if you read pattern formation books, they tell you that just by knowing the symmetries of the problem, you can just immediately write down the form of the amplitude equation. But you can only get the coefficients by rolling up your sleeves and doing the hard work. Okay? And if you ever want to derive an amplitude equation for exact coherent structures from Navier-Stokes, you have to roll up your sleeves and get the coefficients, even though you can't do it analytically. Well, if at all, you know. Okay. Let me also say, right, I'm going to come back to this point. So note, yeah, we'll come back to that in a minute. Two, the bifurcation is supercritical. Everyone's going to agree with that because it's negative. So you learn that. If it's not supercritical, one questions, does this make a lot of sense, because you have a small disturbance, it flies up to some finite amplitude state. You know, what you can do linear analysis, you know, that's useful, tells you about you've got an instability. You do all this work to find out that it's supercritical bifurcation, but I'm not sure whether the, you know, the equation, what does it mean if this is a plus sign?
Go to fifth order.
What's that?
Go to fifth order.
That's always the answer.
Can you get terms to balance asymptotically?
Only if it turns back around.
No, let's say it turns back around. Yeah. I'm saying, can you make sure all the terms are the same size?
And then turn around.
It's not going back
enough.
Like I said, it's an X.
If it's a weak S, then you can do it.
Okay,
but
3
then
was...
You're perturbing around...
All around the critical.
You're perturbing around...
Yeah, critical.
What are you perturbing around?
You're perturbing around the lambda
fold?
Constant going to zero.
That coefficient will be zero. That's what you're perturbing.
At the fold?
Yeah.
No,
at the fold, at the bifurcation.
Right. You can perturb around the cubic coefficient being zero.
So basically,
you
just...
find the place where the cubic coefficient is zero, perturb around that, and go to fifth order.
Okay, I'll come back to that in a minute. Growth rate of, I want to know what you're saying here, sorry. Growth rate of the linear, of KC mode near threshold is R on 2. And that's correct. That bothered me at first because I thought it should be R. But then you go back to the growth rate expression, you convince yourself it's R over 2. It's not a mistake.
So do I interpret this as maybe if you put your equation in some normal form, then you know you have something with an x cubed minus an x fifth or something like this. And so is that a way to check to see if this is going to work?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. And,
you know
in real life, you should check this, you know, using symmetry considerations or normal form considerations, et cetera. But
there's no first derivative in x.
Yep. So there's no advection.
There's no advection.
Yeah, I mean, this is convection.
That's another symmetry consideration. There's no preferred direction, so you can't have the first derivative.
Right.
You know, that's a good point, though, because you could add, stress-free boundaries. This is porous medium, so you don't have the right to impose no slip. I guess you could add a long mode. I wonder if that's just, I didn't include it.
The original problem is though, too, you have to respect that.
Right.
Okay.
That will mean that it would have, because it was...
What's that? That's what they're saying.
Yeah.
I think that's what they're saying. Okay. So my final comment here is, again, in terms of what is, I guess two comments. One is that, yeah, this was weakly nonlinear, right? But that's why I tried to show those pictures earlier and remind everyone of Keith's talk, right? Deriving reduced PDEs, basically using this kind of machinery, but getting reduced PDEs that are not describing patterns near the onset of some linear instability, but rather turbulent dynamics with some filtering that the asymptotics achieved because of the strong external constraint. So that's comment number one. And comment number two is, if you are worried about pattern formation, but strongly nonlinear patterns, not weakly, so modulations of finite amplitude structures rather than modulations of weakly nonlinear structures, then what you find is that the amplitude, so for strongly nonlinear, structures, rolls, or whatever they are, the amplitude, so let's do A bar, the magnitude of the amplitude is slave to the phase. So
why is that? Here phase is arbitrary. Simply because of translation invariance.
And the same is true for if you had strongly nonlinear structures that were modulated.
That statement doesn't seem consistent with that.
Oh, it is consistent. The phase is still an order parameter.
You said A is slave to phase.
Yep. A, magnitude of A is no longer an order parameter. If you tell me, if I tell you an evolution equation for the order parameter of the phase, you can reconstruct the magnitude of the amplitude. So let me.
Is that the definition of strongly?
I don't know. Okay.
Where did you get that?
Let me try to say a few more words. Right. So let's try to understand. In the context of convection, we have, say, Rayleigh-Binard of a pure fluid, even. You know, same kind of machinery near threshold, right? far, you know, but you can do a numerical simulation in a box of a certain domain and compute finite amplitude, maybe that's a better adjective here, nonlinear cells that are also still steady, right? And those structures could also be modulated. They could be unstable, Backhouse instability, I mean, all kinds of things can happen there. You can develop a modulation theory, a pattern formation theory, for those finite amplitude states. But in that condition, in that situation, the amplitude is no longer arbitrary because it's a finite amplitude state that you're starting with, right? So just think operationally. You know, you would compute it numerically. You specify your box size. That's the phase, basically, because the wave number would be related to the phase gradient. And you then compute a heat flux or some measure of the amplitude of that state, right? But because of that translational symmetry, you still have the phase being an ordered parameter. So that's important, I think, for what talking about pattern formation theories, if they can be derived from Navier-Stokes for exact coherent structures.
So normally you wouldn't put the strongly in there, you just have non-linear, I think. Because I sometimes had other meanings.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
But also, I've seen this go the wrong way around, too, where this I get excited about a paper because of this, and then it's weakly nonlinear.
Yeah.
So that's
which means that it's...
How about finite amplitude?
Would be.
I do mean modulated.
Okay. But you didn't say it. You didn't write that down. You just mean that they're connected. You can't just arbitrarily change amplitude.
Right.
That's right.
I have a fundamental question.
Yes.
So, are you meaning away from the threshold?
Yeah.
So, can you still do this separation of scale?
Well, that's what I'm saying, and I think that's where the conversation needs to move when we're talking about trying to develop a pattern formation theory for exact coherent states and shear flows, if that's anyone's interest. Yes, you still can have a separation of scales, for example, in space. You know, you sort of have a large scale over which this finite amplitude pattern is modulated, and the wavelength of that finite amplitude pattern is small by comparison. But yeah, you lose as your small parameter, I would argue in this problem, the small parameter is fundamentally here. It's me dialing down the forcing to be close to threshold. You completely lose that, and it's much more, it seems more risky, right? You have less control over what's going on because you're sort of positing that if I started from an initial condition that had a long wavelength modulation, that the dynamics would stay scale separated. And that may, you know, again, nothing rigorous here, so I could maybe question whether I'd be confident about that or not. But people have derived these types of theories like phase diffusion, mean drift equations for Rayleigh-Binard convection by Newell, Passo, and I can't remember, well, Siegel, I mean, Lega and some others, but I can try to put the references someone had asked. I'll try to put them.
Yeah, put them on this asymptotics page.
Okay. So again, all of this was about multiple scales. Those of you that are familiar with Phil Hall's very nice work on vortex wave interaction and the relation to exact coherent states, that's the other category. That's matched asymptotics. And we have, with my colleague Joe Klawicki and some others at UNH, we've tried to develop a similar type analysis, but for structures that may exist in the inertial region of very high RE tau flows. And so, and it, despite, I didn't want it to work out this way, but it did. I'm on tape here. But the analysis does connect to VWI. So if I ever do talk about that, which I'm clearly not going to do now, you know, I think hopefully, you know, one can also learn a little bit about VWI there.
Can we schedule a time for that if we're not going to do it now?
Yeah, me too.